Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 20th of September 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to be joined by David Scott, and of course, David bringing us northern exposure from north of the border. Defence, Mike, we're talking about it a lot. We are going to continue talking about it because if this country does not control its armed forces, it has ceased to exist as a nation state.
Absolutely. So here's Steve Barclay, the Brexit secretary on the right there. He's meeting Michel Barnier today again to talk Brexit. I won't bore you with the details of that. But yesterday he was meeting the new High Representative of the EU. That's Josep Borrell. Now, of course, he's not quite High Representative yet. Mogherini still has a couple of weeks to go. But they says Barclay saying that this was wide-ranging and positive discussion with the Spanish Foreign Minister and EU High Representative Designate, Josep Borrell, covering the backstop, citizens' rights, Gibraltar, and even some local history. Borrell, of course, hasn't quite taken up his position yet, as I say, but as we reported last week, he has been tasked by the new Commission President-elect, Ursula von der Leyen, with making sure that EU Defence Union happens. And so the question is, were they discussing this topic as well yesterday? Well, we don't know. But it seems a little coincidental that Boris Johnson was pushing out some propaganda on Twitter with some tweets about his undying support for the British military. He has their backs, apparently. He is, you might say, their backstop. Sorry, I apologise to everyone for that one. But let's have a look at the type of thing that Boris was pushing out.
You represent the UK around the world. The four flags that are represented in that union flag. And by goodness, it is respected, admired, loved, and people want to see your presence, believe me. I have absolutely no doubt, wherever I've gone in the world, that people understand that UK armed forces represent the best of this country, the best of all four nations of this country working together, because that is what you incarnate.
So let me bring David Scott onto the programme at this point. Assuming you have stopped throwing up into a bucket there, David, what do you make of that?
Well, none of it rings true unless he starts to tell the British people about European Defence Union. Right? Have either of you ever heard Boris use those words? European Defence Union? Or shall we say, has he used the words lately? I seem to remember there was something 4 or 5 years ago, but now? Why is he silent?
Well, that is the question, but he has their back, so we don't need to worry. Well, or do we? Because James Wells, MEP, pushed out this tweet. The May government negotiated away control of UK intel services and armed forces after we voted for Brexit and inserted this within the withdrawal treaty. MPs have failed by dereliction of duty to understand this threat to the UK. And he points to the Veterans for Britain Whitehall briefing. In fact, had an intervention in the European Parliament. So let's have a look at that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The defence of any country and the means to conduct that defence are essential attributes of sovereignty and are the first responsibility of any government. I am therefore very concerned that the May government collaborated with the Commission after the UK voted to leave to lock Britain's defence and intelligence capabilities into the various EU structures that is intended to subordinate Britain's intelligence and defence capabilities under the control of an unaccountable Commission. This is crystal clear in the political declaration, clauses 104 to 106, which is an integral part of the binding law of the withdrawal agreement under Article 184. I am extremely concerned that UK MPs have failed by a dereliction of their duty to understand this threat. And I would therefore urge our MPs in the UK in the strongest terms to reject any attempt to bring back this awful deal and
Thank
to deliver
you. Your
a clean
time is
Brexit.
Up and our next speaker.
So I have to say that James Wells has to be applauded for that, because for the first time we've seen a politician of any kind putting this situation into the correct language, the correct words, and putting it in the correct frame. And I mean, what have you got thoughts on that?
Well, I think what he did was absolutely excellent, but it is in the EU Parliament. This is what should be happening in Westminster at the moment, that MPs should be standing up and telling the nation the truth about what's happening. But at least it's got out there. UK Column is broadcasting this. Will we see this clip on the BBC? Will we see him interviewed? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Now, you're absolutely right in what you say, but a major step forward, because it was interesting that all the Brexit Party MEPs that were sitting around Mr. Wells were nodding their heads. Many of them have been tweeting out about that over the last couple of days, but still silence from Nigel Farage. And, yeah, you know, while you're talking about MPs, Brian, I have to say that if Nigel Farage had delivered that little piece to a UK audience, if he had managed to get that into British mainstream media, then perhaps we would be having a serious conversation about defence union in this country at this time with respect to Brexit, but he hasn't done that. So Nigel Farage needs to stop talking about an EU army, as I've said in this article published in May this year. He hasn't really changed his tune. And David, that would be a massive step forward.
Yes, and I think the speech by Mr. Wells was a massive step forward, even though it was in the European Parliament, because it was so coherent. I mean, he mentioned sovereignty, the first responsibility of government, the collaboration of the May government, a well-chosen term, subordination under the EU Commission, and the failure of UK parliamentarians. The only bit that I wonder about, he said that the reason that the UK parliamentarians had failed was a dereliction of duty. Perhaps that's the case. Perhaps they are being pressured, perhaps it's a D notice. We actually wonder why the silence, how do you silence 650 people whose very lifeblood is self-promotion and publicity? But they've managed to do this in Westminster on the subject of European Military Union. So how is that done? Is it simply they're all neglecting their duty, or is somebody threatening them with something?
Well, if I can add to that, in my opinion, David, we have a genuine conspiracy going on in Westminster. You've described it as a government of occupation, and I think that's an excellent term. There is a conspiracy in the Conservative Party. There's a conspiracy across the parties, because we see Labour following the same route as the Tories over this one. What sort of conspiracy is it? Well, of course, it's dismantling the constitution of this country. That makes it a criminal conspiracy. And it's backed up by fear and ignorance amongst the other MPs. And we know on the subject of child abuse that MPs are too scared to talk about the subject in the meeting places of Westminster. They want to crawl off into the quiet corners of back corridors because they are worried about standing up to expose it. So I think we're looking at blackmail here, which is a course of what the whip, I've forgotten the gentleman's name now, from
Fortescue, you mean?
Yeah, Tim Fortescue from the whip back in the 1970s said that when MPs came to them with problems such as little boys, it was fixed, so they would do as they're told. We know that the track record of the Parliament in Westminster is blackmail and bullying to get an agenda through. We know from Steve Baker that he said it doesn't matter that people in the UK have voted to come out. The politicians and the core, effectively the civil service, do not want that. And therefore, they are running a conspiracy against the people of this country. I think it's a criminal conspiracy.
Well, in the meantime, of course, on this programme on Monday and Wednesday, we were commenting on Kiefer Hofstadt's presentation to the Liberal Democrats at the weekend. Of course, he was talking about the future world order being a world order of empires, as Britain really needed to be in the European Union, because that was the only way to protect ourselves against the Chinese, the Indians, the United States and the Russian empires. Well, there's been some response to that, David, and we wanted to put this this image of Joe Swinson up, which is doing the rounds on Twitter at the moment. Some people finding this or taking this in the spirit which it was intended, and I think it's a pretty clear message. Others pretty upset about it.
Yes, I just want to highlight it. The degree to which Twitter and memes can really get to the heart of the problem. We all witnessed Geva Hofstad said the future world order is an order of empires, and Europe must be an empire, and countries and nation states are things of the past. Now, that requires a certain degree of consideration to process what that really means. But this image, right, and we saw the Liberal Democrats, mind, stand and applaud and cheer that message. So this image here, which I'm sure is very hurtful for some Liberal Democrats, but this image gets to the core of it, because what you're talking about is a united Europe, German-led empire, and that's been now backed wholeheartedly, comprehensively, without any reservation, by the Liberal Democrats. And I think that image actually communicates that idea very effectively. So, yes, and with a smile and with a bit of humour. So, yes, I thought that was an interesting end point to the discussion following Verhofstadt's really memorable speech.
Yes, absolutely. Now, of course, more hearings yesterday in the Supreme Court. Something quite interesting happened. We'll dismantle this in one second, but just have a look at this from the Supreme Court hearings yesterday.
Prorogation, on the other hand, maintains the government in office without the mechanisms of accountability to Parliament during the period of prorogation. So I say there is an important and significant distinction between the two powers.
Could I just press you a bit more on that? Because from the government's case, their researchers suggest that the only statutory obligation before the Fixed Term Parliament Act, that was, the only statutory obligation was to hold summons a parliament 3 years after the dissolution of the previous one. If that is right, and like you, I haven't had time to check it, then you're really falling back on convention as a check rather than law.
It's a reflection of modern times, and I suppose
Now, David, that's quite spectacular. I believe that's the Lord Advocate of Scotland. Is that correct?
Yes, that's the Lord Advocate of Scotland. That's Mr. Wolfe. He is the head of all criminal prosecution of all sorts in Scotland. He is meant to have no role in the civil matters, but seems to nonetheless be engaged in the civil case. And he's there representing the Scottish government, on whose cabinet he sits as well.
Now, is it a common thing that he should find himself lost for words in that way?
It was quite spectacular. The most cutting comment I saw on Twitter was, to continue playing, please insert further funds. But I think something else is happening here. He's not the most steady under fire. He was actually the man who represented the Scottish government's case to that same court on named person, after which he was made Lord Advocate. And of course, that didn't go well for the government. And he doesn't actually seem to be a very good performer when thinking on his feet is required. But what we're seeing there, that was quite a spectacular breakdown in the flow of argument.
Absolutely. Now, just to make the other point, of course, that was quite a statement from the Supreme Court judge himself, that the government's position is that if you set aside the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, that there's no statutory requirement to hold a parliament until 3 years after the end of the previous parliament. It's a pity that kind of thing doesn't happen a bit more often, isn't it?
Can you imagine the happiness in the country if they just all went away for 3 years? We would all get on fine. We would get more work done. There wouldn't be any new laws to enslave us further. It would be quite a benefit, I think. I remember Israel's currently in mired in political deadlock, and they've had many examples of this. And at one point, they were without a government for about 9 months. And I was speaking to a friend over there and said, how's it going without a government? And he smiled and said, the economy's booming. And that was the end of the conversation. So, yes, I don't think we need them as much as they think we need them.
The only thing that slightly worries me is that I think this would mean that Mark Sedwell would be actually the king.
There is that, but I'm not certain that that's... I think we could all put them in the same pot there. I think.
Okay, but as long anyway. As we can keep Mark Sedwell under control. Yes. If you don't know, Mark Sedwell, of course, is running the civil service and the intelligence services and controlling the budget. So he's a fairly powerful man, to put it mildly, and nobody knows how he got there.
Absolutely. Now, if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, and we do need your support, please head over to ukcolumn.org/community, where there are various options there. A reminder that Ian Crane is continuing with his talks on 5G. Is it safe? All events beginning at 7:30 p.m. Doors opening at 7. We're quite a way through this now. So the next one is in Leicester on Monday, the 23rd of September, and then Nottingham on the 24th, Ipswich on the 25th, Cambridge on the 26th, ending up in Cardiff on the 11th. Details at alternativeview.co.uk. Now, David, you mentioned named person scheme with respect to the Lord Advocate, Mr. Wolf. What's been going on?
Well, yesterday was a bit of a red letter day. It was a brief moment of celebration because Mr. Swinney, the responsible minister, stood up in the Scottish Parliament and announced that the whole thing, at least in a legislative sense, was being scrapped. So here we see the report from the Christian Institute, who led the legal challenge and led the No to Named Person campaign with other organisations. They are saying named person scheme axed by Scottish Government. Parents are celebrating today after the Scottish Government officially announced the end of the intrusive named person scheme. 3 years after, 3 years, gosh, it's been that long. 3 years after the Supreme Court ruled against key elements of the scheme in the case spearheaded by the Christian Institute, the government has finally agreed to repeal the entire named person legislation. So it's all, at least in a statutory sense, going to go.
Sorry, Brian.
Well, I was just going to say, and this really shows people, we have so many people who say, yes, we now understand what's happening in this country, how all of this crass legislation is being brought in, what do we do about it? And it has been consistent work by a relatively small group of people that's brought this change about in Scotland. I don't know whether you'd like to add a bit to that.
Well, it has. This is real people power because the state... developed this in secret. It had every state department on board. It had all of the charities that receive significant government funding involved in developing the scheme. And all of the organisations that are meant to protect our human rights were all either asleep at the wheel or actually enabling this to go forward. So it was left to a small number of individuals to tell the people what the scheme actually was. And the thing that really destroyed it, the legal case was an excellent spearhead and did a lot of damage. But the thing that really destroyed it is they could not persuade the people to accept this intrusion into their lives. And it was getting that message out that really turned the corner for them. So this is the Herald's reporting it here. as a political story. Swinney humiliated as another of his flagship plans is scrapped. Now, this is correct. The Scottish government's having a lot of failures at the moment. But really, the true story here is that a major move into fascism, into totalitarianism, has been defeated by public pressure and helped by the Supreme Court. So it's noticeable that the courts in Scotland all backed the government. But when it went to the Supreme Court, the story was different. The BBC reported it. Here they are, BBC News. Named person scheme scrapped by the Scottish government. Now, in the very next line, the line they put in bold, the strap line underneath the article, they said the following. The Scottish government has scrapped its controversial plan to appoint a named person to safeguard the welfare of every child in the country. So 6 years into a national campaign, which they have been reporting all the way along, the BBC still get it wrong. Just, can we put that slide back up? I just want to emphasise how stupid this is, or craven, because this is the lie that the state's been saying. This is the lie that the state's been pushing the whole time. When there was a debate up in Inverness, and the minister responsible then, Aileen Campbell, was getting ripped apart by people who knew what they were talking about, and she was on the phone, you could hear the advisor whisper to her, child protection. Because the lie that's always been told is this is about child protection. It's about welfare. Welfare is defined in law. Right, it's risk of significant harm. There is nobody in the country who's saying that children should be put at risk of significant harm. That's a lie by the BBC. Right, it's not about welfare. It's about well-being, which means anything the government wants it to mean, and is completely undefined. And 6 years into the campaign, the BBC are still pushing out the lies. It's pathetic. Anyway, we go on. BBC continued. They reported, so they've got to make the government look as good as possible. Okay, this seems to be the answer. In its ruling in 2016, the Supreme Court said the aim of the policy was unquestionably legitimate and benign, but the proposals around information sharing breached the right to privacy and family life under the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, what the Supreme Court actually said was the aim of the Act, which is unquestionably legitimate and benign, is the promotion and safeguarding of the well-being of children and young persons. Right, so they're saying, who could argue that we want to have children and young persons whose well-being is promoted and protected? Fine. But that's not the ringing endorsement, it seems, because if you look at, I've got a quote here from C.S. Lewis, writing in Mere Christianity, and he's talking about the nature of right and wrong and the nature of evil. And he says, the badness consists in pursuing them, which are objectives, by the wrong method, or in the wrong way, or too much. I do not mean, of course, that the people who do this are not desperately wicked. I do mean that wickedness, when you examine it, turns out to be the pursuit of some good in the wrong way. So this is what the named person is. It's wickedness. It's wickedness as defined there. The UK Supreme Court also said more in their finding, which the BBC mysteriously never mention. And the very thing that they don't mention most of all is the following text. This is an extract from the Supreme Court findings. Individual differences are the product of the interplay between the individual person and his upbringing and environment. Different upbringings produce different people. The first thing that a totalitarian regime tries to do is to get at the children, to distance them from the subversive, varied influences of their families and indoctrinate them in the ruler's view of the world. Within limits, families must be left to bring up their children in their own way. That is never mentioned by the BBC. Now, the dear BBC go on and they do a whole article about, well, how we got here and what happens now. Right? And they list here that similar schemes will operate in some areas on a voluntary basis. Oh, yeah. So within an hour of Swinney announcing that the scheme was being scrapped as a statutory scheme, the Scottish government tweeted out a little video. I've got two stills from it here. A named person can offer help to families if and when they need it, and they carry on because it then gets to the information sharing issue. And they reassure people they won't routinely share wellbeing information without families' knowledge. Knowledge? No, Scottish Government. The word that they can't use, the word that they are terrified of, is the C word, consent. It's not knowledge, it's consent. So families have to remember that. People in Scotland, remember that. They can't share your information without your consent. Now, I've closed with this little tweet. I had a discussion with a gentleman on Twitter. Transpired he was a practitioner in Scotland in the social work, child safeguarding type area. He didn't go into details. So he said to me, you can have your view, scrapped or not, adults who work with children and their families will still do the right thing at the right time to find solutions to keep children safe. So here, this is the end product of 10 years of government propaganda into the civil service and into the services that interact with families. He used the word safe, despite the fact it's not about safety. So that's indoctrination by the government. And he's repeating the government mantra that's been pushed into the local authorities for a decade now, that you must intervene early using the wisdom of these people in government to see when things need to be done before there's any real harm, before there's any concern. And that imbalance between families and the state is a good thing. This is the sort of indoctrination that we've had for 10 years in Scotland. So just repealing the bill isn't the whole story. We have to undo the decades worth of harm that's been done to how services, how organisations like social work departments and local authorities actually operate, because it's the belief system that's now inculcated into those organisations that's actually conducting the harm that's affecting families.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much for that, David. Now, if the BBC is guilty of pushing out some disinformation with respect to an in-person scheme, we don't need to worry, because the EU is here to do something about that, because according to them on Medium, the Medium blog site, the EU is fighting disinformation in 10 ways. And it's the title of it is 10 Ways the EU is Fighting Disinformation. So go and look for it if you would like. They are improving detection and analysis. They've apparently got a dedicated team now whose job it is to identify examples of disinformation targeting the EU and its citizens. They're protecting the integrity of elections. They're debunking EU-related myths. We have developed a series of tailored propaganda, well, they didn't say propaganda campaigns, but that's what it is, in different EU countries, debunking the local variations on those Euro myths. They're bringing EU countries together. That's fantastic, with a dedicated digital platform, the Rapid Alert System. They are cooperating with online platforms like Google, Facebook, Twitter, Microsoft. They've signed a voluntary EU-wide code of practice on disinformation. They're promoting media literacy by holding various events like the European Media Literacy Week. They're empowering civil society, because you need NGOs and citizen-run organisations on your side. Empowering, I presume, means paying, but there you go. They're facilitating the work of fact-checkers, because we need fact-checkers. We can't check things for ourselves. Improving societal resistance. When citizens are aware about the positive impact of the EU's policies and values on their everyday lives, they also become more resilient to the negative effects of disinformation. So I guess that's also about propaganda. They're doing this through communication campaigns, Invest EU, EU and Me, and EU Protect. That all sounds woolly and fluffy and gentle, and I'm very delighted about the fact that those exist, and supporting quality journalism, because of course we have to support the BBC and their ilk around the EU, and only by doing that can we promote media freedom. And they also, though, they say that they do provide support to independent media and investigative journalists. Well, in the meantime, yet more news following the revelation by Reuters and Oxford University that young people and stupid people are not engaging with the new mainstream press. And, well, we've got a new announcement that ITV's response to this now is to set this up, The Rundown. So they have launched a social media campaign on Instagram, on Snapchat and on Facebook stories aimed at 14 to 17-year-olds. These are daily what they're describing as made for mobile episodes. They're going to be released at 3:45 every day to make sure that as children come out of school and college, they can get on their mobile phone straight away and head over to ITV News to get the latest updates on what's going on in the world. So, you know, how can we possibly be sad about that?
Well, because it's propaganda and nonsense, and I wonder if that lady should be out of school herself, actually, even running the programme. Let's run it into this. So for some considerable time now, there's been a dispute running over the teaching of relationship and sex education in Birmingham. This is now spreading to other parts of the UK as parents realise that young children are being grossly over-sexualised in this new government agenda. BBC, of course, has reported almost nothing on the concerns of the parents. They've simply focused on what the government line is. So this was from a couple of months ago, Birmingham school LGBT protest, probably harassment. Now, we reported that this was not simply a protest from Muslim parents. Let's remember, though, it's in a largely Muslim area, so we might expect the majority of parents to be Muslim. This is a little bit too complicated for the BBC. But where are we today? Well, we've got this amazing headline here. This is Dame Louise Casey. And she said that basically the government have imposed a radio silence over the true nature of the protests. Now, before you get excited and think she's on the right line, what she's actually doing is spinning it back to try and say that the parents are concerned about the LGBT aspect, and they are absolutely not. What they are saying is they consider the children too young to be given this very, very explicit sex education. But this lady is spinning a story. This is how the BBC does it. Look at the image on screen there. So we've got everything to reinforce that this nasty protest is simply those horrible Muslim parents. When the truth of this is that we've got Muslims, Christians and Jewish community people standing shoulder to shoulder to protest at the sexualisation of their young children. The BBC will not investigate this story properly because it is too dangerous to the government. Because, of course, if different faiths and different communities say we're not having this RSC education, then what we've got is parents thinking for themselves, and it doesn't matter what their colour or background or faith is. So here's, Is that the first one? Yeah. The protest, according to Dame Louise Casey, former civil service fixer, she's described as in several places, the protests stem from a lack of integration with some deprived communities struggling to mix with other ethnic groups. We're not fitting in those kids for what the world is, and actually this is a multicultural, multi-faith country, and we're very proud of it, but it shows you a picture of some families in some of these areas being very closed. So this is pretty unpleasant stuff, because she's not getting to the heart of it. No, these families are saying that the sex education is too much, too early, it's gross, it's offensive, and they don't want it. And she's trying to blame it on some Muslim families who are not fitting into the culture. I did actually jump part of that. Let me just pop back here a minute. She said, if I was gay and watching what was happening in Birmingham, I would say it was discriminatory. When you see it on the television, what I hear is homophobia, and homophobia is not a value I want any child to grow up and learn. So she doesn't get out there and meet some of the families herself and talk to them and find out what the concern is. What she actually does is helps the BBC spin the whole story. David, you often say that the experiment on the population is in Scotland first, but we are seeing some very, very dangerous stuff being unleashed here. They want the minds of our children. They want to capture them at the youngest possible age. And the BBC, as on the named person scheme, is prepared to utterly lie in its reports in order to get this agenda through.
Yes, they lie, and they look the other way when they're not lying. We're seeing the same sort of agenda being promoted in Scotland, and when we ask the Scottish Government who authored the report that actually generated this, we were told it was a secret and we were not allowed to know. When we see the people who are running the policy out in local authorities, and we can identify one or two of them, they're extremely militant LGBT activists. These are people who have an evangelical, sorry to use the word, but that's the best I can come up with, enthusiasm for spreading their view of the world. And it's a political and, to some extent, religious view of the world that they are pushing. This is not about protecting children from being bullied in the other ways that it's sold. It's about something else entirely.
Yeah.
And we're not allowed to know what that is. The true issues are never debated. It's all done in secret.
It's all done in secret. We'll have more on that a little bit later. But let's just come in at this angle. This was a report a while back from the Metro, UK's first permanent LGBT rainbow road crossing unveiled in London. Now, I got a letter a couple of days ago sent to me by a gentleman, Atwell, and he's from the Oxford African Caribbean Conversation. He'd sent in this letter to his council, which is planning to do the same thing. Let me read a little bit of it. Dear Chief Executive Officer, the elected leader of the County Council stated that the County Council instigated, authorised and funded the repainting of the zebra crossing directly opposite County Hall in Oxford City Centre in the colours adopted, promoted, associated as the uniform of the LGBTQIA plus people. What was the cost to the public purse? He goes on to ask, why should the concerns of the LGBTQIA plus people benefit from this exceptional treatment from a publicly funded but austerity suffering County Council? Were sufficient considerations given to the health and safety of thousands of pedestrians, many who are tourists, who are accustomed to seeing zebra crossings in the traditional black and white livery? I think that's a very good question, actually, very good. He talks about the Road Traffic Acts, but then he goes on to say, if this is in the name of equality, what consideration has been given to possibly painting zebra crossings in the flag of St George or the national flag or the Scottish flag? So very good letter. I'll try and get more of this out, but it shows that clearly across the country, people are waking up to this dangerous government propaganda, and they're starting to see that all sorts of minority groups are actually being used and abused for a political agenda. And possibly it appears it's LGBT here.
Well, of course, these families that are protesting at the schools are not being given the right of self-expression. They're not. They're being rode roughshod over, which is all a bit ironic. Now, the other day we mentioned this, the OSCE. This is the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Human Dimension Implementation Meeting. That's taking place in Poland and Warsaw at the moment. I'm just going to read out what they say about themselves once again, because it is fantastic. They say it is Europe's largest annual human rights and democracy conference. They organise it every year in Warsaw as a platform for the 57 OSCE participating states, the OSCE partners for cooperation, OSCE structures, civil society, international organisations and other relevant actors to take stock of the implementation of OSCE human dimension commitments, discuss associated challenges, share good practices and make recommendations for further improvement. Well, there you go. That's what that's about, just as a reminder. But you'll be glad to know that the UK delegation to the OSCE has delivered a message with respect to freedom of expression. This is delivered by Helen Teasdale, who's the first secretary of the UK delegation to the OSCE. And she said, promoting and defending human rights, including freedom of thought, conscience, religion or belief, is a priority for the United Kingdom. David, perhaps you could explain to me how this statement fits with what Brian has just been reporting with respect to sexual education in Midland schools.
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't in the slightest. It doesn't fit with Murray's experience in Mayans Academy that we reported on some weeks ago. If you speak out and you are out with the tiny area of approved opinion, which is actually not even static, it keeps changing, you will be attacked. You will be called names and you will be shut down. And if you do not consent to be shut down, then things can get very nasty indeed, including criminal charges and all the rest of it. That statement just does not tally with what we're seeing in Britain.
Yep, so we're in a dangerous condition when, of course, what we're being told doesn't fit with those policies. So let's follow through on the subject of climate change, which of course is all over the news. Now, a gentleman came to see me last few days. He's from Brecon, and he pointed out the local Brecon newspaper that they were advertising a lot of stuff to do with climate change. And this man, Dr. Aaron Thierry, was back for his second lecture about climate change. And of course, that's all backed by Extinction Rebellion. So here he is. Aaron Thierry explores the risks and realities of climate change. Must we change? I found him on Climate State. Interesting website, because as you go through it, you start to ask yourself, who funds all this? And I haven't got all the answers. So if somebody can help me with what this website is about, I'd be very grateful. But I also noticed that what the Brecon newspaper was advertising was this one, Strike Like a 16-Year-Old. And what's this to do with? Well, this is to get children on the street. So Global Climate Strike Brecon, bring along those children, get the children out of the schools, get them into our agenda that we've got a climate change problem, and let us indoctrinate them. And of course, it's not happening, just happening in Brecon. Here we are with Plymouth school students to hold a die-in in Plymouth City Centre tomorrow. And Extinction Rebellion was going flat out to get children at that event, although it appears that Plymouth City Council wasn't too happy. I've got to look into this a little bit more, but clearly this statement would suggest that since they were after university students to make up for school children who've been denied their rights after being threatened by school authorities, it seems that Plymouth City Council was maybe not holding this nonsense. But remember what we said about Extinction Rebellion. Their plan, their declared plan, is to break the law. And they were going to get people who were prepared to be arrested and go to prison. And we also pointed out this excellent report by Policy Exchange, which said that not only are they breaking the law, these people want revolution. This is a very dangerous movement. And I went looking to see who was warning children. Let's Talk About It is one organisation. Difficult to know who runs them, so I had a look at their partner organisations. And what did we come to? This one, Educate Against Hate. Wasn't sure who that was, so we gave them a call. And what we quickly discovered was that this was being run by the Department of Education. But they really didn't react very well when we said, if Extinction Rebellion is declared, it's breaking the law, it wants people to break the law, and it is recruiting school children, what is your policy? Well, you heard a bit of the conversation, Mike. It was just incredible, because the gentleman in counter extremism in the Department of Education wouldn't give his name, wouldn't give any details. And when I later spoke to the Department of Education and asked them about this strange organisation in their midst, the young lady on the press team had no idea it existed, but she couldn't really see the problem that Extinction Rebellion is openly calling for people to break the law, and it's openly pulling children out of school to do that. It's amazing, isn't it?
It seems, David, that if you're going to be considered an extremist in this country, you either have to be a Muslim or you have to be on the right wing of politics. If you're a left-wing extremist, and no matter what you call on people to do, there's no implications for that.
That's right. There are no limits. There are no limits at all, it would seem. And yes, it's not just if you're a Muslim, if you're a Christian, and pretty soon if you're a Jew as well, I think the same problems will come your way.
Absolutely.
Okay, I think that probably brings us to David.
Well, just to, could we just finish off, just to explain to people how immune the left is from criticism. the cheerleader in Canada for every assault on individual liberty, for compelling speech, and for using identity politics and cultural Marxism to change society is one Justin Trudeau. He's been in the press this week. Did you see why, Mike?
Yes. There you go.
Yes, there he is.
On screen. Now,
there are many things that are troubling about this, and it transpires this is one of, so far, three examples of him in blackface. In one, he had a curly black wig and was singing the Banana Boat song. There is apparently a £10,000 reward for anyone who has video of that. So he's doing the I am sorry thing, having spent his entire career using identity politics to divide and loot people in ever more ingenious ways, having used the minorities to attack the self-confidence and belief in their own culture of the Canadian people, of the people who are related to the British by family ties, they've got to believe that they are evil by virtue of their birth and their skin colour. Having done all of that to his own society, it now transpires he has some quite, shall we say, troubling relationship with how he views people whose skin is dark. So what we'll now see, I predict, is a remarkable forgiveness of this from the left, because they want what he's offering, what he's selling, and he will double down and he will become even more toxic to his own country. But we'll see. It's certainly been a very funny moment in the week's news.
Yes.
Okay, David, thank you for that. We'll end there. I'll just say that moments before we went live, the postman delivered a letter from Carol Woods. So I've had quite a lot of communication from people who've been worried about Carol Woods. Carol Woods was the former social worker who spoke out about the stealing of babies. She has been in a psychiatric unit. That has been the technique to try and silence her. But I just wanted to say I've received a letter. It seems to be well written. I'll read it after the news and we will report back to our viewers and listeners. That's it for today. Take heart from what's been achieved in Scotland with the no to named persons scheme. It can be done. It requires enough people to protest and put pen to paper to hold those MPs to account. And maybe we'll be lucky the next Parliament will be in 3 years.
Hopefully.
We'll see. Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.